Chapter 1. Future primitive division of labor, which has had so much to do with bringing us to the present global crisis, works daily to prevent our understanding the origins of this horrendous present. Mary Lachron Foster, 1990, surely errs on the side of understatement in allowing that anthropology is today, end quote, in danger of serious and damaging fragmentation, end quote. Shanks and Tilly, 1987b, voice a rare, related challenge, end quote. The point of archaeology is not merely to interpret the past but to change the manner in which the past is interpreted in the service of social reconstruction in the present, end quote. Of course, the social sciences themselves work against the breadth and depth of vision necessary to such a reconstruction. In terms of human origins in development, the array of splintered fields and subfields, anthropology, archaeology, paleontology, ethnology, paleobotany, ethnoanthropology, etc., etc., mirrors the narrowing, crippling effect that civilization has embodied from its very beginning. Nonetheless, the literature can provide highly useful assistance, if approached with an appropriate method and awareness and the desire to proceed past its limitations. In fact, the weakness of more or less orthodox modes of thinking can and does yield to the demands of an increasingly dissatisfied society. Unhappiness with contemporary life becomes distrust with the official lies that are told to legitimate that life, and a truer picture of human development emerges. Renunciation and subjugation in modern life have long been explained as necessary concomitants of and quote, human nature, end quote. After all, our pre-civilized existence of deprivation, brutality, and ignorance made authority a benevolent gift that rescued us from savagery, end quote. Caveman and quote, and Neanderthal are still invoked to remind us where we would be without religion, government, and toil. This ideological view of our past has been radically overturned in recent decades through the work of academics like Richard Lee and Marshall Salins. A nearly complete reversal in anthropological orthodoxy has come about, with important implications. Now we can see that life before domestication, agriculture was in fact largely one of leisure, intimacy with nature, sensual wisdom, sexual equality, and health. This was our human nature, for a couple of million years, prior to enslavement by priests, kings, and bosses. And lately another stunning revelation has appeared, a related one that deepens the first and may be telling us something equally important about who we were and what we might again become. The main line of attack against new descriptions of gatherer-hunter life has been, though often indirect or not explicitly stated, to characterize that life, condescendingly, as the most an evolving species could achieve at an early stage. Thus, the argument allows that there was a long period of apparent grace and pacific existence, but says that humans simply didn't have the mental capacity to leave simple ways behind in favor of complex social and technological achievement. In another fundamental blow to civilization, we now learn that not only was human life once, and for so long, a state that did not know alienation or domination, but as the investigation since the 80s by archaeologists John Fowlett, Thomas Wynne, and others have shown, those humans possessed an intelligence at least equal to our own. At a stroke, as it were, the ignorance thesis is disposed of, and we contemplate where we came from in a new light. To put the issue of mental capacity in context, it is useful to review the various, and again, ideologically loaded, interpretations of human origins and development. Robert Ardrey, 1961-1976, served up a bloodthirsty, macho version of prehistory, as have to slightly lesser degrees Desmond Morris and Lionel Tiger. Similarly, Freud and Konrad Lorenz wrote of the innate depravity of the species, thereby providing their contributions to hierarchy and power in the present. Fortunately, a far more plausible outlook has emerged, one that corresponds to the overall version of Paleolithic life in general. Food sharing has for some time been considered an integral part of earliest human society, e.g. Washburn and Dever, 1961. Jane Goodall, 1971, and Richard Leakey, 1978, among others, have concluded that it was the key element in establishing our uniquely Homo development at least as early as 2 million years ago. This emphasis, carried forward since the early 70s by Linton, Zillman, Tanner, and Isaac, has become ascendant. One of the telling arguments in favor of the cooperation thesis, as against that of generalized violence and male domination, involves a diminishing, during early evolution, of the difference in size and strength between males and females. Sexual dimorphism, as it is called, was originally very pronounced, including such features as prominent canines or enquat, fighting teeth enquat, in males and much smaller canines for the female. The disappearance of large male canines strongly suggests that the female of the species exercised a selection for sociable, sharing males. Most apes today have significantly longer and larger canines, male to female, in the absence of this female choice. Capacity, Zillman 1981, Tanner 1981. Division of labor between the sexes is another key area in human beginnings, a condition once simply taken for granted and expressed by the term hunter-gatherer. Now it is widely accepted that gathering of plant foods, once thought to be the exclusive domain of women and of secondary importance to hunting by males, constituted the main food source, Johansson and Shreve 1989. Since females were not significantly dependent on males for food, Hamilton 1984, it seems likely that rather than division of labor, flexibility and joint activity would have been central, Bender 1989. As Zillman, 1981, points out, an overall behavioral flexibility may have been the primary ingredient in early human existence. Joan Jarrow, 1991, has demonstrated that stone tools were as likely to have been made by women as by men, and indeed, Poirier, 1987, reminds us that there is, in quote, no archaeological evidence supporting the contention that early humans exhibited a sexual division of labor, end quote. It is unlikely that food collecting involved much, if any, division of labor, Slocum 1975, and probably that sexual specialization came quite late in human evolution, Zillman 1981, Crater and Isaac 1981. So if the adaptation that began our species centered on gathering, when did hunting come in? Binford, 1984, has argued that there is no indication of use of animal products, i.e. evidence of butchery practices, until the appearance, relatively quite recent, of anatomically modern humans. Electron microscope studies of fossil teeth found in East Africa, Walker 1984, suggest a diet composed primarily of fruit, while a similar examination of stone tools from a 1.5-million-year-old site at Kubi Fora in Kenya, Keeley and Toth 1981, shows that they were used on plant materials. The small amount of meat in the early Paleolithic diet was probably scavenged, rather than hunted, Ehrenberg 1989b. The natural condition of the species was evidently a diet made up largely of vegetables rich in fiber, as opposed to the modern high-fat and animal protein diet with its attendant chronic disorders. Mendeloff 1977. Though our early forebears employed their enquat, detailed knowledge of the environment and cognitive mapping enquat, Zillman 1981, in the service of a plant gathering subsistence, the archaeological evidence for hunting appears to slowly increase with time. Hodder, 1991. Much evidence, however, has overturned assumptions as to widespread prehistoric hunting. Collections of bones seen earlier as evidence of large kills of mammals, for example, have turned out to be, upon closer examination, the results of movement by flowing water or caches by animals. Lewis Binfords and Quat. Were there elephant hunters at Toralba? And Quat, 1989, is a good instance of such a closer look, in which he doubts there was significant hunting until 200,000 years ago or sooner. Adrian Zillman, 1981, has concluded that and Quat. Hunting arose relatively late in evolution, and Quat. May not extend beyond the last 100,000 years, and Quat. And there are many, e.g. Strauss 1986, Trinkhouse 1986, who do not see evidence for serious hunting of large mammals until even later, viz. The later Upper Paleolithic, just before the emergence of agriculture. The oldest known surviving artifacts are stone tools from Hadar in eastern Africa. With more refined dating methods, they may prove to be 3.1 million years old, Klein 1989. Perhaps the main reason these may be classified as representing human effort is that they involve the crafting of one tool by using another, a uniquely human attribute so far as we know. Homo habilis, or in Quat, handyman, and Quat, designates what has been thought of as the first known human species, its name reflecting association with the earliest stone tools, Coppens 1989. Basic wooden and bone implements, though more perishable and thus scantily represented in the archaeological record, were also used by Homo habilis as part of a and Quat, remarkably simple and effective and Quat, adaptation in Africa and Asia, Fagan 1990. Our ancestors at this stage had smaller brains and bodies than we do. But Poirier, 1987, notes that and Quat, their postcranial anatomy was rather like modern humans, and Quat. And Holloway, 1972, 1974, allows that his studies of cranial endocasts from this period indicate a basically modern brain organization. Similarly, tools older than 2 million years have been found to exhibit a consistent right-handed orientation in the ways stone has been flaked off in their formation. Right-handedness as a tendency is correlated in moderns with such distinctly human features as pronounced lateralization of the brain and marked functional separation of the cerebral hemispheres. Holloway 1981. Klein, 1989, concludes that and Quat, basic human cognitive and communicational abilities are almost certainly implied, and Quat, Homo erectus is the other main predecessor to Homo sapiens, according to long-standing usage, appearing about 1.75 million years ago as humans moved out of forests into drier, more open African grasslands. Although brain size alone does not necessarily correlate with mental capacity, the cranial capacity of Homo erectus overlaps with that of moderns such that this species and Quat must have been capable of many of the same behaviors and Quat, Chachone, Olson and Thames 1990. As Johansson and Eady, 1981, put it, and Quat, if the largest brained erectus were to be rated against the smallest brained sapiens, all their other characteristics ignored, their species names would have to be reversed. And Quat, Homo Neanderthalus, which immediately preceded us, possessed brains somewhat larger than our own. Delson, 1985, Holloway 1985, Donald 1991. Though of course the much maligned Neanderthal has been pictured as a primitive, brutish creature, in keeping with the prevailing Habesian ideology, despite manifest intelligence as well as enormous physical strength, Shreve 1991. Recently, however, the whole species framework has become a doubtful proposition. Day 1987, Reitmeier 1990. Attention has been drawn to the fact that fossil specimens from various Homo species and Quat all show intermediate morphological traits and Quat, leading to suspicion of an arbitrary division of humanity into separate taxa. Gingerich 1979, Tobias 1982, Fagan 1989, for example, tells us that in Quat, it is very hard to draw a clear taxonomic boundary between Homo erectus and archaic Homo sapiens on the one hand, and between archaic and anatomically modern Homo sapiens on the other, and Quat. Likewise, Foley 1989, and Quat. The anatomical distinctions between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens are not great, and Quat. Jelinek 1978, flatly declares that in Quat, there is no good reason, anatomical or cultural in Quat, for separating erectus and sapiens into two species, and has concluded, 1980, that people from at least the Middle Paleolithic onward and Quat may be viewed as Homo sapiens and Quat, as does Hublin 1986. The tremendous upward revision of early intelligence, discussed below, must be seen as connected to the present confusion over species, as the ones prevailing overall evolutionary model gives way. But the controversy over species categorization is only interesting in the context of how our earliest forebears lived. Despite the minimal nature of what could be expected to survive so many millennia, we can glimpse some of the texture of that life, with its often elegant, pre-division of labor approaches. The Enquat, toolkit Enquat, from the Olduvai Gorge area made famous by the Lakeys, contains Enquat, at least six clearly recognizable tool types Enquat, dating from about 1.7 million years ago, M. Lakey, 1978. There soon appeared the Acheulean handaxe, with its symmetrical beauty, in use for about a million years. Teardrop-shaped, and possessed of a remarkable balance, it exudes grace and utility from an era much prior to symbolization. Isaac, 1986, noted that in Quat, the basic needs for sharp edges that humans have can be met from the varied range of forms generated from Olduvai, patterns of stone flaking, and Quat. Wondering how it came to be thought that in Quat, more complex equals better adapted, and Quat, in this distant early time, according to cut marks found on surviving bones, humans were using scavenged animal sinews and skins for such things as cord, bags, and rugs. Gowlett 1984. Further evidence suggests furs for cave wall coverings and seats, and seaweed beds for sleeping. Butzer 1970. The use of fire goes back almost 2 million years, Kemp 1988, and might have appeared even earlier but for the tropical conditions of humanity's original African homeland, as Poirier, 1987, implies. Perfected fire-making included the firing of caves to eliminate insects and heated pebble floors. Pearls 1975, Lumley 1976, amenities that show up very early in the Paleolithic. As John Gowlett, 1986, notes, there are still some archaeologists who consider anything earlier than Homo sapiens a mere 30,000 years ago, as greatly more primitive than we and Quat, fully human and Quat, types. But along with the documentation, referred to above, of fundamentally modern brain anatomy even in early humans, this minority must now contend with recent work depicting complete human intelligence as present virtually with the birth of the Homo species. Thomas Wynne, 1985, judged manufacture of the Acheulean handaxe to have required in Quat a stage of intelligence that is typical of fully modern adults. And Quat. Gowlett, like Wynne, examines the required in Quat operational thinking and quat, involved. In the right hammer, the right force and the right striking angle, in an ordered sequence and with flexibility needed for modifying the procedure. He contends that manipulation, concentration, visualization of form in three dimensions, and planning were needed, and that these requirements, end quote, were the common property of early human beings as much as 2 million years ago, and this, end quote, he adds, end quote, is hard knowledge, not speculation, end quote. During the vast time span of the Paleolithic, there were remarkably few changes in technology, Rollin 1990. Innovation, end quote. Over 2.5 million years measured in stone tool development was practically nil, end quote. According to Gerhard Krauss, 1990, seen in the light of what we now know of prehistoric intelligence, such stagnation is especially vexing to many social scientists. End quote. It is difficult to comprehend such slow development, end quote, in the judgment of Weimer, 1989. It strikes me as very plausible that intelligence, informed by the success and satisfaction of a gatherer-hunter existence, is the very reason for the pronounced absence of progress, division of labor, domestication, symbolic culture. These were evidently refused until very recently. Contemporary thought, in its postmodern incarnation, would like to rule out the reality of a divide between nature and culture, given the abilities present among people before civilization. However, it may be more accurate to say that basically, they long chose nature over culture. It is also popular to see almost every human act or object as symbolic, e.g. Botchero 1989, a position which is, generally speaking, part of the denial of a nature versus culture distinction. But it is culture as the manipulation of basic symbolic forms that is involved here. It also seems clear that reified time, language, written, certainly, and probably spoken language for all or most of this period, number, and art had no place, despite an intelligence fully capable of them. I would like to interject, in passing, my agreement with Goldschmidt, 1990, that and quote, the hidden dimension in the construction of the symbolic world is time, and quote, and as Norman O. Brown put it, and quote, life not repressed is not in historical time, and quote, which I take as a reminder that time as a materiality is not inherent in reality, but a cultural imposition, perhaps the first cultural imposition, on it. As this elemental dimension of symbolic culture progresses, so does, by equal steps, alienation from the natural. Cohen, 1974, has discussed symbols as in quote, essential for the development and maintenance of social order, end quote, which implies, as does, more forcefully, a great deal of positive evidence, that before the emergence of symbols there was no condition of disorder requiring them. In a similar vein, Levi Strauss, 1953, pointed out that in quote, mythical thought always progresses from the awareness of oppositions toward their resolution, end quote, so whence the absence of order, the conflicts are in quote, oppositions, end quote. The literature on the Paleolithic contains almost nothing that deals with this essential question, among thousands of monographs on specific features. A reasonable hypothesis, in my opinion, is that division of labor, unnoticed because of its glacially slow pace, and not sufficiently understood because of its newness, began to cause small fissures in the human community and unhealthy practices vis-a-vis nature. In the later Upper Paleolithic, and quote, 15,000 years ago, we begin to observe specialized collection of plants in the Middle East, and specialized hunting, and quote, observed Gowlett, 1984. The sudden appearance of symbolic activities, e.g. ritual and art, in the Upper Paleolithic has definitely seem to archaeologists one of prehistory's and quote, big surprises and quote, Binford 1972b, given the absence of such behaviors in the Middle Paleolithic, Foster 1990, Kozlowski 1990. But signs of division of labor and specialization were making their presence felt as a breakdown of wholeness and natural order, a lack that needed redressing. What is surprising is that this transition to civilization can still be seen as benign. Foster, 1990, seems to celebrate it by concluding that the unquote, symbolic mode dot has proved extraordinarily adaptive, else why has Homo sapiens become material master of the world? End quote. He is certainly correct, as he is to recognize and quote, the manipulation of symbols, to be the very stuff of culture, and quote, but he appears oblivious to the fact that this successful adaptation has brought alienation and destruction of nature along too their present horrifying prominence. It is reasonable to assume that the symbolic world originated in the formulation of language, which somehow appeared from a unquote, matrix of extensive nonverbal communication unquote, Tanner and Zillman 1976, and face-to-face contact. There is no agreement as to when language began, but no evidence exists of speech before the cultural explosion of the later Upper Paleolithic, Dibble 1984, 1989. It seems to have acted as an unquote, inhibiting agent, unquote, a way of bringing life under unquote, greater control unquote, Mumford 1972, stemming the flood of images and sensations to which the pre-modern individual was open. In this sense it would have likely marked an early turning away from a life of openness and communion with nature, toward one more oriented to the overlordship and domestication that followed symbolic culture's inauguration. It is probably a mistake, by the way, to assume that thought is advanced, if there were such a thing as neutral thought, whose advance could be universally appreciated, because we actually think in language. There is no conclusive evidence that we must do so. Allport 1983. There are many cases. LaCourse and Jonet 1980, Levine et al. 1982, involving stroke and like impairments of patients who have lost speech, including the ability to talk silently to themselves, who were fully capable of coherent thought of all kinds. These data strongly suggest that in quote, human intellectual skill is uniquely powerful, even in the absence of language and quote, Donald 1991. In terms of symbolization in action, Goldschmidt 1990 seems correct in judging that and quote, the upper Paleolithic invention of ritual may well have been the keystone in the structure of culture that gave it its great impetus for expansion, and quote, ritual has played a number of pivotal roles in what Hodder, 1990, termed in quote, the relentless unfolding of symbolic and social structures in quote, accompanying the arrival of cultural mediation. It was as a means of achieving and consolidating social cohesion that ritual was essential. Johnson 1982, Conkey 1985, totemic rituals, for example, reinforce clan unity. The start of an appreciation of domestication, or taming of nature, is seen in a cultural ordering of the wild, through ritual. Evidently, the female is a cultural category, viz. Seen as wild or dangerous, dates from this period. The ritual and quote, Venus and quote, figurines appear as of 25,000 years ago, and seem to be an example of earliest symbolic likeness of women for the purpose of representation and control, Hodder 1990. Even more concretely, subjugation of the wild occurs at this time in the first systematic hunting of large mammals. Ritual was an integral part of this activity, Hammond 1974, Frisson 1986. Ritual, as shamanic practice, may also be considered as a regression from that state in which all shared a consciousness we would now classify as extrasensory, Leonard 1972. When specialists alone claim access to such perceptual heights as may have once been communal, further backward moves in division of labor are facilitated or enhanced. The way back to bliss through ritual is a virtually universal mythic theme, promising the dissolution of measurable time, among other joys. This theme of ritual points to an absence that it falsely claims to fill, as does symbolic culture in general. Ritual is a means of organizing emotions, a method of cultural direction and restraint. Introduces art, a facet of ritual expressiveness, Bender 1989. End quote. There can be little doubt, end quote. To Gans, 1985, end quote, that the various forms of secular art derive originally from ritual, end quote. We can detect the beginning of an unease, a feeling that an earlier, direct authenticity is departing. Labar, 1972, I believe, is correct in judging that and quote, art and religion alike arise from unsatisfied desire, end quote, at first, more abstractly as language, then more purposively as ritual and art. Culture steps in to deal artificially with spiritual and social anxiety. Ritual and magic must have dominated early, Upper Paleolithic, art and were probably essential, along with an increasing division of labor, for the coordination and direction of community, Weimer 1981. Similarly, Pfeiffer 1982, has depicted the famous Upper Paleolithic European cave paintings as the original form of initiating youth into now complex social systems. As necessary for order and discipline, see also Gamble 1982, Joachim 1983. And art may have contributed to the control of nature, as part of development of the earliest territorialism, for example, Strauss 1990. The emergence of symbolic culture, with its inherent will to manipulate and control, soon opened the door to domestication of nature. After 2 million years of human life within the bounds of nature, in balance with other wild species, agriculture changed our lifestyle, our way of adapting, in an unprecedented way. Never before has such a radical change occurred in a species so utterly and so swiftly, Pfeiffer 1977. Self-domestication through language, ritual, and art inspired the taming of plants and animals that followed, appearing only 10,000 years ago. Farming quickly triumphed, for control, by its very nature, invites intensification. Once the will to production broke through, it became more productive the more efficiently it was exercised, and hence more ascendant and adaptive. Agriculture enables greatly increased division of labor, establishes the material foundations of social hierarchy, and initiates environmental destruction. Priests, kings, drudgery, sexual inequality, warfare are a few of its fairly immediate specific consequences. Ehrenberg 1986b, Weimer 1981, Festinger 1983. Whereas Paleolithic peoples enjoyed a highly varied diet, using several thousand species of plants for food, with farming these sources were vastly reduced, White 1959, Gaudi 1986. Given the intelligence and the very great practical knowledge of Stone Age humanity, the question has often been asked, and quote, why didn't agriculture begin, at say, 1 million BC rather than about 8,000 BC, end quote. I have provided a brief answer in terms of slowly accelerating alienation in the form of division of labor and symbolization, but given how negative the results were, it is still a bewildering phenomenon. Thus, as Binford, 1968, put it, and quote, the question to be asked is not why agriculture dot was not developed everywhere, but why it was developed at all, end quote. The end of gatherer-hunter life brought a decline in size, stature, and skeletal robusticity. Cohen and Armalagos, 1981, Harris and Ross, 1981, and introduced tooth decay, nutritional deficiencies, and most infectious diseases. Larson, 1982, Bickstra, 1976a, Cohen, 1981. End quote. Taken as a whole, an overall decline in the quality and probably the length of human life, end quote, concluded Cohen and Armalagos, 1981. Another outcome was the invention of number, unnecessary before the ownership of crops, animals, and land that is one of agriculture's hallmarks. The development of number further impelled the urge to treat nature as something to be dominated. Writing was also required by domestication for the earliest business transactions and political administration. Larson, 1988. Levi Strauss has argued persuasively that the primary function of written communication was to facilitate exploitation and subjugation. 1955, cities and empires, for example, would be impossible without it. Here we see clearly the joining of the logic of symbolization and the growth of capital. Conformity, repetition, and regularity were the keys to civilization upon its triumph, replacing the spontaneity, enchantment, and discovery of the pre-agricultural human state that survived so very long. Clark, 1979, cites a gatherer-hunter and quote, amplitude of leisure, and quote, deciding and quote, it was this and the pleasurable way of life that went with it, rather than penury and a day-long grind, that explains why social life remained so static, end quote. One of the most enduring and widespread myths is that there was once a golden age, characterized by peace and innocence, and that something happened to destroy this idle and consign us to misery and suffering. Eden, or whatever name it goes by, was the home of our primeval forager ancestors, and expresses the yearning of disillusioned tillers of the soil for a lost life of freedom and relative ease. The once rich environs people inhabited prior to domestication and agriculture are now virtually non-existent. For the few remaining foragers there exist only the most marginal lands, those isolated places as yet unwanted by agriculture. And surviving gatherer-hunters, who have somehow managed to evade civilization's tremendous pressures to turn them into slaves, i.e. farmers, political subjects, wage laborers, have all been influenced by contact with outside peoples. Lee, 1976, Mithin, 1990. Duffy, 1984, points out that the present-day gatherer-hunters he studied, the Buti Pygmies of Central Africa, have been acculturated by surrounding villager agriculturalists for hundreds of years, and to some extent, by generations of contact with government authorities and missionaries. And yet it seems that an impulse toward authentic life can survive down through the ages. End quote. Try to imagine, end quote, he counsels, end quote, a way of life where land, shelter, and food are free, and where there are no leaders, bosses, politics, organized crime, taxes, or laws. Add to this the benefits of being part of a society where everything is shared, where there are no rich people and no poor people, and where happiness does not mean the accumulation of material possessions, end quote. The Buti have never domesticated animals or planted crops. Among the members of non-agriculturalist bands resides a highly sane combination of little work and material abundance. Bodley, 1976, discovered that the San, aka Bushmen, of the harsh Kalahari Desert of southern Africa work fewer hours, and fewer of their number work, than do the neighboring cultivators in times of drought. Moreover, it has been the San to whom the farmers have turned for their survival. Lee, 1968. They spend and quote, strikingly little time laboring and much time at rest and leisure, end quote. According to Tanaka, 1980, while others, e.g. Marshall 1976, Gunther 1976, have commented on sand vitality and freedom compared with sedentary farmers, their relatively secure and easygoing life. Flood, 1983, noted that to Australian Aborigines and Quat, the labor involved in tilling and planting outweighed the possible advantages. End quote. Speaking more generally, Tanaka, 1976, has pointed to the abundant and stable plant foods in the society of early humanity, just as in Quat, they exist in every modern gatherer society. End quote. Likewise, Festinger, 1983, referred to Paleolithic access to and quote, considerable food without a great deal of effort, and quote, adding that and quote, contemporary groups that still live on hunting and gathering do very well, even though they have been pushed into very marginal habitats, end quote. As Hole and Flannery, 1963, summarized, end quote, no group on earth has more leisure time than hunters and gatherers, who spend it primarily on games, conversation and relaxing, end quote. They have much more free time, adds Binford, 1968, end quote, than do modern industrial or farm workers, or even professors of archaeology, end quote. The non-domesticated know that, as Van Ejem, 1975, put it, only the present can be total. This by itself means that they live life with incomparably greater immediacy, density and passion than we do. It has been said that some revolutionary days are worth centuries, until then and quote, we look before and after, and quote, as Shelley wrote, and quote, and sigh for what is not, and quote, the booty believe, Turnbull 1976, that and quote, by a correct fulfillment of the present, the past and the future will take care of themselves, end quote. Primitive peoples do not live through memories, and generally have no interest in birthdays or measuring their ages, Cipriani 1966. As for the future, they have little desire to control what does not yet exist, just as they have little desire to control nature. Their moment by moment joining with the flux and flow of the natural world does not preclude an awareness of the seasons. But this does not constitute an alienated time consciousness that robs them of the present. Though contemporary gatherer-hunters eat more meat than their prehistoric forebears, vegetable foods still constitute the mainstay of their diet in tropical and subtropical regions, Lee 1968A, Yellen in Lee 1976. Both the Kalahari sand and the Hazda of East Africa, where game is more abundant than in the Kalahari, rely on gathering for 80% of their sustenance, Tanaka 1980. The Kung branch of the sand search for more than 100 different kinds of plants, Thomas 1968, and exhibit no nutritional deficiency, Truswell and Hansen 1976. This is similar to the healthful, varied diet of Australian foragers, Fisher 1982, Flood 1983. The overall diet of gatherers is better than that of cultivators, starvation is very rare, and their health status generally superior, with much less chronic disease, Lee Endeavour 1968A, Ackerman 1990. Lauren van der Post, 1958, expressed wonder at the exuberant San laugh, which rises and quat, sheer from the stomach, a laugh you never hear among civilized people, and quat. He found this emblematic of a great vigor and clarity of senses that yet manages to withstand and elude the onslaught of civilization. Truswell and Hansen, 1976, may have encountered it in the person of a San who had survived an unarmed fight with a leopard. Although injured, he had killed the animal with his bare hands. The Andaman Islanders, west of Thailand, have no leaders, no idea of symbolic representation, and no domesticated animals. There is also an absence of aggression, violence, and disease. Wounds heal surprisingly quickly, and their sight and hearing are particularly acute. They are said to have declined since European intrusion in the mid-19th century, but exhibit other such remarkable physical traits as a natural immunity to malaria, skin with sufficient elasticity to rule out post-childbirth stretch marks and the wrinkling we associate with aging, and an unbelievable strength of teeth. Cipriani, 1966. Reported seeing children of 10 to 15 years crush nails with them. He also testified to the Andamese practice of collecting honey with no protective clothing at all, end quote, yet they are never stung. And watching them, one felt in the presence of some age-old mystery, lost by the civilized world, end quote. De Vries, 1952, has cited a wide range of contrasts by which the superior health of gatherer-hunters can be established, including an absence of degenerative diseases and mental disabilities, and childbirth without difficulty or pain. He also points out that this begins to erode from the moment of contact with civilization. Relatedly, there is a great deal of evidence, not only for physical and emotional vigor among primitives but also concerning their heightened sensory abilities. Darwin described people at the southernmost tip of South America who went about almost naked in frigid conditions, while Peasley, 1983, observed Aborigines who were renowned for their ability to live through bitterly cold desert nights and quote, without any form of clothing, end quote. Levi Strauss, 1979, was astounded to learn of a particular South American tribe which was able to end quote, see the planet Venus in full daylight, end quote, a feat comparable to that of the North African Dogon, who consider Sirius B the most important star, somehow aware, without instruments, of a star that can only be found with the most powerful of telescopes, Temple, 1976. In this vein, Boyden, 1970, recounted the Bushman ability to see four of the moons of Jupiter with the naked eye. In The Harmless People, 1959, Marshall told how one Bushman walked unerringly to a spot in a vast plain, and quote, with no bush or tree to mark place, and quote, and pointed out a blade of grass with an almost invisible filament of vine around it. He had encountered it months before in the rainy season when it was green. Now, in parched weather, he dug there to expose a succulent root and quenched his thirst. Also in the Kalahari Desert, Van der Post, 1958, meditated upon San Bushman communion with nature, a level of experience that in quote, could almost be called mystical. For instance, they seemed to know what it actually felt like to be an elephant, a lion, an antelope, a steenbok, a lizard, a striped mouse, mantis, baobab tree, yellow-crested cobra or starry-eyed amaryllis, to mention only a few of the brilliant multitudes through which they moved, and quote, it seems almost pedestrian to add that gatherer-hunters have often been remarked to possess tracking skills that virtually defy rational explanation, e.g. Lee, 1979. Rorlick-Levitt, 1976, noted, end quote, the data show that gatherer-hunters are generally non-territorial and bi-local, reject group aggression and competition, share their resources freely, value egalitarianism and personal autonomy in the context of group cooperation, and are indulgent and loving with children, end quote. Dozens of studies stress communal sharing and egalitarianism as perhaps the defining traits of such groups, e.g. Marshall 1961 and 1976, Salins 1968, Pilbeam 1972, Damis 1972, Diamond 1974, Lafitau 1974, Tanaka 1976 and 1980, Wiesner 1977, Morris 1982, Riches 1982, Smith 1988, Mithun 1990. Lee. 1982, referred to the unquote universality among foragers and quote of sharing, while Marshall's classic 1961 work spoke of the unquote ethic of generosity and humility and quote informing a unquote strongly egalitarian and quote gatherer-hunter orientation. Tanaka provides a typical example, and quote the most admired character trait is generosity, and the most despised and disliked are stinginess and selfishness. End quote. Bear, 1986, listed in quote egalitarianism, democracy, personalism, individuation, nurturance and quote as key virtues of the non-civilized, and Lee, 1988, cited in quote an absolute aversion to ranked distinctions and quote among and quote simple foraging peoples around the world and quote. Leacock and Lee, 1982, specified that and quote any assumption of authority and quote within the group and quote leads to ridicule or anger among the Kung, as has been recorded for the Booty, Turnbull, 1962, the Hazda, Woodburn 1980, and the Montane Niscapi, Thwaites 1906, among others. End quote. End quote. Not even the father of an extended family can tell his sons and daughters what to do. Most people appear to operate on their own internal schedules, end quote. Reported Lee, 1972, of the Kung of Botswana. Ingold, 1987, judged that end quote in most hunting and gathering societies, a supreme value is placed upon the principle of individual autonomy, and quote, similar to Wilson's finding, 1988, of and quote, an ethic of independence and quote, that is and quote, common to the focused open societies, and quote. The esteemed field anthropologist Radin, 1953, went so far as to say, and quote, free scope is allowed for every conceivable kind of personality outlet or expression in primitive society. No moral judgment is passed on any aspect of human personality as such. End quote. Turnbull, 1976, looked on the structure of Booty social life as in quote an apparent vacuum, a lack of internal system that is almost anarchical. End quote. According to Duffy, 1984, and quote, the Booty are naturally acephalous, they do not have leaders or rulers, and decisions concerning the band are made by consensus, end quote. There is an enormous qualitative difference between foragers and farmers in this regard, as in so many others. For instance, agricultural Bantu tribes, e.g. the Saga, surround the San, and are organized by kingship, hierarchy and work. The San exhibit egalitarianism, autonomy, and sharing. Domestication is the principle which accounts for this drastic distinction. Domination within a society is not unrelated to domination of nature. In gatherer-hunter societies, on the other hand, no strict hierarchy exists between the human and the non-human species, NOSC 1989, and relations among foragers are likewise non-hierarchical. The non-domesticated typically view the animals they hunt as equals. This essentially egalitarian relationship is ended by the advent of domestication, when progressive estrangement from nature became outright social control. Agriculture, more than just social attitudes, changed descriptions by sailors and explorers who arrived in and quote newly discovered and quote regions tell how wild mammals and birds originally showed no fear at all of the human invaders. Brock, 1981. A few contemporary gatherers practiced no hunting before outside contact, but while the majority certainly do hunt, end quote, it is not normally an aggressive act, end quote. Rohrlich Levitt, 1976. Turnbull, 1965, observed, "Booty hunting is quite without any aggressive spirit, even carried out with a sort of regret." Hewitt, 1986, reported a sympathy bond between hunter and hunted among the San Bushmen he encountered in the 19th century. As regards violence among gatherer hunters, Lee, 1988, found that and quote, "the Kung hate fighting, and think anybody who fought would be stupid," end quote. The Booty, by Duffy's account, 1984, end quote, "look on any form of violence between one person and another with great abhorrence and distaste, and never represent it in their dancing or play-acting," end quote. Homicide and suicide, concluded Bodley, 1976, are both, end quote, "decidedly uncommon," end quote, among undisturbed gatherer-hunters. The warlike nature of Native American peoples was often fabricated to add legitimacy to European aims of conquest. Kroeber, 1961, the foraging Comanche maintained their nonviolent ways for centuries before the European invasion, becoming violent only upon contact with marauding civilization. Fried, 1973. The development of symbolic culture, which rapidly led to agriculture, is linked through ritual to alienated social life among extant foraging groups. Block, 1977, found a correlation between levels of ritual and hierarchy. Put negatively, Woodburn, 1968, could see the connection between an absence of ritual and the absence of specialized roles in hierarchy among the Hazda of Tanzania. Turner's study of the West African Ndembu, 1957, revealed a profusion of ritual structures and ceremonies intended to redress the conflicts arising from the breakdown of an earlier, more seamless society. These ceremonies in structures function in a politically integrative way. Ritual is a repetitive activity for which outcomes and responses are essentially assured by social contract. It conveys the message that symbolic practice, via group membership and social rules, provides control. Cohen, 1985. Ritual fosters the concept of control or domination, and has been seen to tend toward leadership roles. Hitchcock, 1982, and centralized political structures. Lurondos, 1985. A monopoly of ceremonial institutions clearly extends the concept of authority. Bender, 1978, and may itself be the original formal authority. Among agricultural tribes of New Guinea, leadership and the inequality it implies are based upon participation in hierarchies of ritual initiation or upon shamanistic spirit mediumship. Kelly, 1977, Modjeska, 1982. In the role of shamans, we see a concrete practice of ritual as it contributes to domination in human society. Radin, 1937, discussed and quote, "the same marked tendency," and quote, "among Asian and North American tribal peoples for shamans or medicine men," end quote, to organize and develop the theory that they alone are in communication with the supernatural, end quote. This exclusive access seems to empower them at the expense of the rest. Lomel, 1967, saw and quote, "an increase in the shaman's psychic potency, counterbalanced by a weakening of potency in other members of the group," end quote. This practice has fairly obvious implications for power relationships in other areas of life, and contrasts with earlier periods devoid of religious leadership. The Batuk of Brazil are host to shamans who each claim control over certain spirits. An attempt to sell supernatural services to clients, rather like priests of competing sects. S. Leacock, 1988. Specialists of this type in and quote, "magically controlling nature," would naturally come to control men, too, and quote, in the opinion of Muller, 1961. In fact, the shaman is often the most powerful individual in pre-agricultural societies, e.g. Xi'an 1985, he is in a position to institute change. Johannesson, 1987, offers the thesis that resistance to the innovation of planting was overcome by the influence of shamans among the Indians of the American Southwest, for instance. Similarly, Marquardt, 1985, has suggested that ritual authority structures have played an important role in the initiation and organization of production in North America. Another student of American groups, Ingold, 1987, saw an important connection between shamans' role in mastering wildness in nature and an emerging subordination of women. Burnt, 1974, has discussed the importance among Aborigines of ritual sexual division of labor in the development of negative sex roles, while Randolph, 1988, comes straight to the point, and quote, ritual activity is needed to create proper men and women, end quote. There is, end quote, no reason in nature, end quote, for gender divisions, argues Bender, 1989, end quote. They have to be created by proscription and taboo, they have to be naturalized through ideology and ritual, end quote. But gatherer-hunter societies, by their very nature, deny ritual its potential to domesticate women. The structure, non-structure, of egalitarian bands, even those most oriented toward hunting, includes a guarantee of autonomy to both sexes. This guarantee is the fact that the materials of subsistence are equally available to women and men, and that, further, the success of the band is dependent on cooperation based on that autonomy. Leacock, 1978, Friedel, 1975. The spheres of the sexes are often somewhat separate, but inasmuch as the contribution of women is generally at least equal to that of men, social equality of the sexes is, in quote, a key feature of forager societies, in quote. Ehrenberg, 1989b. Many anthropologists, in fact, have found the status of women in forager groups to be higher than in any other type of society, e.g. Fluor-Laban, 1979, Rohrlich-Levitt, Sykes and Weatherford, 1975, Leacock, 1978. In all major decisions, observed Turnbull, 1970, of the booty, and quote, men and women have equal say, hunting and gathering being equally important, end quote. He made it clear, 1981, that there is sexual differentiation, probably a good deal more than was the case with their distant forebears, end quote, but without any sense of superordination or subordination, end quote. Men actually work more hours than women among the Kung, according to Post and Taylor, 1984. It should be added, in terms of the division of labor common among contemporary gatherer-hunters, that this differentiation of roles is by no means universal. Nor was it when the Roman historian Tacitus wrote, of the Feni of the Baltic region, that, in quote, the women support themselves by hunting, exactly like the men, dot and count their lot happier than that of others who groan over field labor, end quote. Or when Procopius found, in the 6th, sup, th, sup, century AD, that the Serathiphini of what is now Finland, end quote, neither till the land themselves, nor do their women work it for them, but the women regularly join the men in hunting, end quote. The Tiwa women of Melville Island regularly hunt, Martin and Voorhees, 1975, as do the Agta women in the Philippines, Estioco Griffin and Griffin, 1981. In booty society, end quote, there is little specialization according to sex. Even the hunt is a joint effort, end quote, reports Turnbull, 1962, and Kotlow, 1971. Testifies that, in quote, among the traditional Eskimos it is, or was, a cooperative enterprise for the whole family group, end quote. Darwin, 1871, found another aspect of sexual equality, end quote, in utterly barbarous tribes. The women have more power in choosing, rejecting, and tempting their lovers, or of afterwards changing their husbands, than might have been expected, end quote. The Kung Bushmen in Booty exemplify this female autonomy, as reported by Marshall, 1959, and Thomas, 1965, end quote. Women apparently leave a man whenever they are unhappy with their marriage, end quote, concluded Begler. 1978. Marshall, 1970, also found that rape was extremely rare or absent among the Kung. An intriguing phenomenon concerning gatherer-hunter women is their ability to prevent pregnancy in the absence of any contraception, Silberbauer, 1981. Many hypotheses have been put forth and debunked, e.g. conception somehow related to levels of body fat, Frisch, 1974, Leibowitz, 1986. What seems a very plausible explanation is based on the fact that undomesticated people are very much more in tune with their physical selves. Foraging women's senses and processes are not alienated from themselves or dulled. Control over childbearing is probably less than mysterious to those whose bodies are not foreign objects to be acted upon. The pygmies of Zaire celebrate the first menstrual period of every girl with a great festival of gratitude and rejoicing, Turnbull, 1962. The young woman feels pride and pleasure, and the entire band expresses its happiness. Among agricultural villagers, however, a menstruating woman is regarded as unclean and dangerous to be quarantined by taboo, Duffy, 1984. The relaxed, egalitarian relationship between San men and women, with its flexibility of roles and mutual respect, impressed Draper, 1971, 1972, 1975, a relationship, she made clear, that endures as long as they remain gatherer-hunters and no longer. Duffy, 1984, found that each child in an Booty camp calls every man father and every woman mother. Forager children receive far more care, time, and attention than do those in civilizations. Isolated nuclear families. Post and Taylor, 1984, described the unquote, almost permanent contact unquote, with their mothers and other adults that Bushmen children enjoy. Kung infants, studied by Ainsworth, 1967, showed marked precocity of early cognitive and motor skills development. This was attributed both to the exercise and stimulation produced by unrestricted freedom of movement, and to the high degree of physical warmth and closeness between Kung parents and children, see also Connor, 1976. Draper, 1976, could see that in quote, competitiveness in games is almost entirely lacking among the Kung, and quote, as Shostak, 1976, observed in quote, Kung boys and girls playing together and sharing most games, end quote. She also found that children are not prevented from experimental sex play, consonant with the freedom of older Booty youth to end quote, indulge in premarital sex with enthusiasm and delight end quote, Turnbull, 1981. The Zuni end quote, have no sense of sin, end quote. Ruth Benedict, 1946, wrote in a related vein, end quote, chastity as a way of life is regarded with great disfavor. Pleasant relations between the sexes are merely one aspect of pleasant relations with human beings. Sex is an incident in a happy life, end quote. Kuntz and Henderson, 1986, point to a growing body of evidence in support of the proposition that relations between the sexes are most egalitarian in the simplest foraging societies. Women play an essential role in traditional agriculture, but receive no corresponding status for their contribution, unlike the case of gatherer-hunter society, Chevillard and LeConte, 1986, White, 1978. As with plants in animals, so are women subject to domestication with the coming of agriculture. Culture, securing its foundations with the new order, requires the firm subjugation of instinct, freedom, and sexuality. All disorder must be banished, the elemental and spontaneous taken firmly in hand. Women's creativity and their very being as sexual persons are pressured to give way to the role, expressed in all peasant religions, of Great Mother, that is, fecund breeder of men and food. The men of the South American Munduruk, a farming tribe, refer to plants and sex in the same phrase. About subduing women, and quat, we tame them with the banana and quat. Murphy and Murphy, 1985. Simone de Beauvoir, 1949, recognized in the equation of the plow and the phallus a symbol of male authority over women. Among the Amazonian Jivaro, another agricultural group, women are beasts of burden in the personal property of men. Harner, 1972, the enquat abduction of adult women is a prominent part of much warfare enquat by these lowland South American tribes. Ferguson, 1988. Brutalization and isolation of women seem to be functions of agricultural societies. Gregor, 1988, and the female continues to perform most or even all of the work in such groups. Morgan, 1985. Head hunting is practiced by the above-mentioned groups as part of endemic warfare over coveted agricultural land. Lathrap, 1970, head hunting and near-constant warring is also witnessed among the farming tribes of Highlands, New Guinea. Watson, 1970. Lenski and Lenski's 1974 researches concluded that warfare is rare among foragers but becomes extremely common with agrarian societies. As Wilson, 1988, put it succinctly, and quote, revenge, feuds, rioting, warfare and battle seem to emerge among, and to be typical of, domesticated peoples, end quote. Tribal conflicts, Godelier, 1977, argues, are, end quote, explainable primarily by reference to colonial domination and quote, and should not be seen as having an origin and quote, in the functioning of pre-colonial structures, end quote. Certainly contact with civilization can have an unsettling, degenerative effect, but Godelier's Marxism, viz. Unwillingness to question domestication, production, is, one suspects, relevant to such a judgment. Thus it could be said that the Copper Eskimos, who have a significant incidence of homicide within their group, Damis, 1972, owe this violence to the impact of outside influences, but their reliance on domesticated dogs should also be noted. Ahrens, 1979, has asserted, paralleling Godelier to some extent, that cannibalism is a cultural phenomenon is a fiction, invented and promoted by agencies of outside conquest. But there is documentation of this practice, e.g. Poole, 1983, Tuzin, 1976. Among, once again, peoples involved in domestication. The studies by Hogg, 1966, for example, reveal its presence among certain African tribes, steeped in ritual and grounded in agriculture. Cannibalism is generally a form of cultural control of chaos, in which the victim represents animality, or all that should be tamed, Sande, 1986. Significantly, one of the important myths of Fiji Islanders, and quote, how the Fijians first became cannibals, and quote, is literally a tale of planting. Salins, 1983. Similarly, the highly domesticated and time-conscious Aztecs practiced human sacrifice as a gesture to tame unruly forces and uphold the social equilibrium of a very alienated society. As Norbeck, 1961, pointed out, non-domesticated, and quote, culturally impoverished and quote, societies are devoid of cannibalism and human sacrifice. As for one of the basic underpinnings of Violence in More Complex Societies, Barnes, 1970, found that in Quat, reports in the ethnographic literature of territorial struggles in Quat, between gatherer-hunters are in Quat, extremely rare, and Quat Kung boundaries are vague and undefended, Lee 1979, Pandarum territories overlap, and individuals go where they please, Morris 1982, Hazda move freely from region to region, Woodburn 1968. Boundaries and trespass have little or no meaning to the Bhuti, Turnbull 1966, and Australian Aborigines reject territorial or social demarcations, Gumpert 1981, Hamilton 1982. An ethic of generosity and hospitality takes the place of exclusivity, Stewart 1968, Hyatt 1968. Gatherer-hunter peoples have developed in Quat, no conception of private property, and Quat, in The Estimation of Kitwood, 1984. As noted above in reference to sharing, and with Sansom's 1980 characterization of Aborigines as in Quat, people without property, and Quat, foragers do not share civilization's obsession with externals, and Quat, mine and thine, the seeds of all mischief, have no place with them, and Quat, wrote Pietro, 1511, of the native North Americans encountered on the second voyage of Columbus. The Bushmen have in Quat, no sense of possession, and Quat, according to Post, 1958. And Lee, 1972, saw them making in Quat, no sharp dichotomy between the resources of the natural environment and the social wealth, and Quat, there is a line between nature and culture, again, and the non-civilized choose the former. There are many gatherer-hunters who could carry all that they make use of in one hand, who die with pretty much what they had as they came into the world. Once humans shared everything, with agriculture, ownership becomes paramount and a species presumes to own the world. A deformation the imagination could scarcely equal. Salins, 1972, spoke of this eloquently, and Quat, the world's most primitive people have few possessions, but they are not poor. Poverty is not a certain small amount of goods, nor is it just a relation between means and ends. Above all, it is a relation between people. Poverty is a social status. As such, it is the invention of civilization. And Quat, the and Quat, common tendency in Quat, of gatherer-hunters in Quat, to reject farming. Until it was absolutely thrust upon them in Quat, Bodley 1976, bespeaks a nature-culture divide also present in the Bhuti recognition that if one of them becomes a villager he is no longer in Bhuti. Turnbull 1976. They know that forager band and agriculturalist village are opposed societies with opposed values. At times, however, the crucial factor of domestication can be lost sight of. And Quat, the historic foraging populations of the western coast of North America have long been considered anomalous among foragers, and Quat, declared Cohen, 1981, as Kelly, 1991, also put it. And Quat, tribes of the northwest coast break all the stereotypes of hunter-gatherers, and Quat, these foragers, whose main sustenance is fishing, have exhibited such alienated features as chiefs, hierarchy, warfare and slavery. But almost always overlooked are their domesticated tobacco and domesticated dogs. Even this celebrated anomaly contains features of domestication. Its practice, from ritual to production, with various accompanying forms of domination, seems to anchor and promote the facets of decline from an earlier state of grace. Thomas, 1981, provides another North American example, that of the Great Basin Shoshones and three of their component societies, the Kawich Mountain Shoshones, Reese River Shoshones, and Owens Valley Paiutes. The three groups showed distinctly different levels of agriculture, with increasing territoriality or ownership and hierarchy closely corresponding to higher degrees of domestication. To define a desalienated world would be impossible and even undesirable, but I think we can and should try to reveal the unworld of today and how it got this way. We have taken a monstrously wrong turn with symbolic culture and division of labor, from a place of enchantment, understanding and wholeness to the absence we find at the heart of the doctrine of progress. Empty and emptying, the logic of domestication with its demand to control everything now shows us the ruin of the civilization that ruins the rest. Assuming the inferiority of nature enables the domination of cultural systems that soon will make the very earth uninhabitable. Postmodernism says to us that a society without power relations can only be an abstraction, Foucault, 1982. This is a lie unless we accept the death of nature and renounce what once was and what we can find again. Turnbull spoke of the intimacy between booty people and the forest, dancing almost as if making love to the forest. In the bosom of a life of equals that is no abstraction, that struggles to endure, they were and quat, dancing with the forest, dancing with the moon, and quat.